Hey everybody, this is Eric Mueller, the host of The Eric Mueller Show. You're tuned into the podcast that explores what makes any successful person's inner clock tick by unlocking the most impactful tools within their success portfolio. I'm joined today by Emmanuel Daniel, a global thought leader in the future of finance and founder of The Asian Banker. Let's head on over to the interview. Emmanuel, welcome to the show.
Eric, thanks for having me on. And great, we've got a lot of ground to cover, so let's just get right on to it.
Let's get started, man. Yeah, and but before we even dive deep into this entrepreneurial story and your expertise regarding personalization of finance and the geopolitical navigation as an entrepreneur, we want to know what makes up your success portfolio. So if you're new to this show, real quick background on it, think about it like an investment portfolio that has that compilation of your financial assets that make up your financial goals and push you towards that financial future you're chasing. Well, here on The Eric Mueller Show, I want to discover how successful people like Emmanuel invest in themselves and build that foundation for success. So Emmanuel, start us off here with this. What are some skills or traits, habits or mindsets that make up your success portfolio?
You know, Eric, what made me successful 20 years ago looks very different from what makes people successful today. I started a business called the Asian Banker, and then which now is a conglomerate of different titles like Wealth and Society and so on. I was an employee who made the transition to entrepreneur at an age in 1996 when startup capital was not floating around the way it does today. Today, you don't go out there and represent yourself as an entrepreneur if you don't have the skill of going out for capital and from the word go. In my time, you build your business organically. You go through days when you can't pay your bills and hold your breath. And then every cent you make, you save, put that together. So in those days, wealth or assets would be your pension fund, some of the savings you were putting together, and your introduction to securities, and that was it. You just needed to just spend enough time to build on it. And today, you add fixed assets like properties, and then alternative assets like Bitcoin and paintings, which I like, I've been collecting collectibles is something that you build on when you go through the mid phase of your entrepreneurial journey. You start taking an interest in things that are not related to the things that you're making money on, and you use that to plug into things that you're interested in and stuff like that. And then the rules just totally changed. Today, if you are a startup and you can get good funding and you're walking up the series league from series A to B to C, the wealth just gets created as you go up the league. It's got nothing to do with the solidity of your business, and you need to be able to monetize and asset and turn into assets the money that is passing by you. So it's just a totally different mindset today from the days when I was building my own wealth, and I'm learning from what there is. So for example, right now, I'm turning the business that I run into a platform for investments into similar businesses of the businesses that I understand, publishing, research, consulting, that sort of thing. And it's my ability to attract other investors that defines my success today in a way that didn't define my success in the early days of my entrepreneurship journey. And I also must say that for those of us who come from families that don't have a history of entrepreneurship, we got to learn all this stuff ourselves. The instinct, you either have the instinct and you make it up as you go, or you learn it from scratch. So It's quite different from, you know, a lot of young people today whose parents worked in large corporations and who start off with, you know, with very comfortable levels of capital with which they can go out and build ideas. Their mindset is really very different. So, I mean, I'm just throwing out to you my journey and what I see happening today, or rather the profile of an entrepreneur today.
Yeah, and I think a further piece to this question kind of tees out a little bit more from you here, Emmanuel, is what really is success to you? If someone asks you to define that word, what would you say it is now, and how maybe has that changed throughout your life as you've, you know, gone through the entrepreneurship piece and also done a lot of traveling?
Yeah, I now do a lot of traveling because the work itself doesn't turn me on. You know, I'm on a new journey now, and that's why I'm able to go out there and see the rest of the world while the business itself is humming along. And the best thing that an entrepreneur can do is to get out of the way of the people who are, you know, the next generation who's coming in there, want to prove themselves, you know, want to have the right to make decisions, stuff like that. So I'm actually at that phase in my own life, in the life of the business that I run, and the people who work with me. You know, the age difference is such that they are mostly in their mid-30s to early 40s, where they want to prove something that is in their league. And a whole lot of things that I used to do that I've become very tired over, now I just allow them to take on and build on it. And I have to redefine myself. And that's how I ended up writing my first book last year. You know, I put out my personal ambition to go out and see all the 185 countries in the world. You know, I've done about 115 so far. And as I do that, I'm redefining myself. So that's where I am in my own journey. You know, and I think that all of us should be giving ourselves each, you know, new targets as we go along. If you're not doing that, something inside us is dying.
Yeah, and you said 115 countries. So you're over halfway to being to every single country. That's ridiculous. That's really, really impressive, Emmanuel. What do you say that's taught you over the years? You know, maybe as a person, as an entrepreneur, what is the biggest takeaway that you've learned through all of that traveling and putting yourself out there?
You know, Eric, the first 90 countries were work related. You know, like I wasn't even thinking about going out and seeing the whole world. It's just that work took me from one country to the next. I would go out for a conference, and then that adds up and all that. After 90, I looked at it and I said, you know what? I think I can do the rest. And then COVID struck, by which time I'd done 95, 96, something like that. And then I said, after COVID, and in fact, right in the midst of COVID, I said, you know what? I cannot give myself an excuse not to do the rest of the countries in the world. And one of the things that I found that I had to pull myself out of during COVID was the idea of becoming too comfortable with an ecosystem that you're familiar with. It could be anywhere in the world. I mean, I'm from Singapore, so I live in Singapore. I live in a beautiful apartment that looks out to the sea and the city skyline. You know, if you're Chicago, you just imagine what the Chicago skyline looks out from the lake. That's exactly the view I have. You know, and there's no reason to give up something that you have and to go out there. So then I went out to China, where I've been doing business since 2000, but I lived there properly for 2 years, 2 years and a bit. And in that 2 years, because there was, you know, lockdown, you couldn't get into China. But once you're in China, you're free to travel within the country. I made it a point to go out and see every historical place that I had not been in the previous 20 years. You know, and then I was getting the hang of it. And then, you know, when I published my book, I was in the U.S. for 7 months, and I've been going back to the U.S. all the time and all that. The thing that I think that first strikes you, I call it the cab driver scene. You know, all of us who come from any local community have a story to tell about the local cab drivers. You know, they've got an attitude, they get upset over the smallest thing. And you get upset over them over the smallest thing. But when you look at your own little local cab driver from the perspective of 115 countries, you realize how endearing it is, how small it is in the context of many things. And then you start to appreciate him in context, and then you start seeing things that are similar between cab drivers in many different countries. In fact, cab drivers are one of the first people that I sit in the front seat and I ask them lots of questions, and I learn as much as I can about, the local community and things that you never understand, if you're just reading about them and so on. So I also have a rule, which is that I don't consider myself having visited a country unless I've done a minimum of 3 days, and I've done some of the major institutions, whether it's a church or a museum or something that's important in that country, and then work my way through that way. And sometimes I just stay 2 weeks. I'm not in a hurry to see all the countries in the world. In fact, I think that it's important to spend time to connect the dots, as it were. And in the process, you start seeing things that are common between countries that have nothing to do with each other. So Rwanda in Africa, China, Indonesia in Southeast Asia have something in common, and Ghana. In Ghana, I was there a few years ago, and the political process is pretty stable, meaning that they've got peaceful transfer of power and so on. And the politicians sort of, gripe at each other, but, it's basically a peaceful country. And so is Rwanda today. And when I ask the people in these countries, why is it that, you've got such great stability today? And the answer that they give me is because we've seen the difference, or rather because we've seen the alternative. Because we've seen the alternative. And then when I go around to new countries and see the level of stability, I look at the period in which they've seen the alternative. So in China, for example, they've seen the Cultural Revolution. And because of the Cultural Revolution, they'll do anything not to go back there. And therefore the race towards prosperity, wealth, personal liberties and all that. Same thing in Indonesia. They saw the alternative during the Asian financial crisis of 1997. And today it's a trillion-dollar economy, and they're not going back to where they were coming from. And so when I see countries that are really successful today, I try to look back and see the inflection point at which they started. Another country that's very interesting right now is Bangladesh. A previous Secretary of State in the U.S. Called Bangladesh a basket case in the 1970s. No hope in hell of becoming a middle-income country. And today, it's got a GDP that per capita GDP that's higher than its neighbor, India. And that's because through natural disasters, political upheavals, and so on, they've built incredible levels of grassroots support that has, added up over the years, and it's become an incredible story of a textile-driven economy. It's a country that's well on its way to middle income. If they just keep at what they're doing right now, so you see trends between countries that otherwise you think have nothing to do with each other. You see inflection points in trying to decide which countries have a chance of becoming successful. In fact, something that that I'm very aware of coming from this part of Asia is that if in the 1950s, that is at the end of World War II, and at the start of the ending of the colonial era, if you were to ask which countries had the best chance of becoming successful countries, you would have named Sri Lanka, Burma, and the Philippines in 1950, right? And the reason was these three countries had Western influence, had institutions well in place, the judiciary, the separation of powers, the rule of law and all of that. They spoke English. They had some of the best universities in the world at that time. You know, the University of Rangoon was where Rudyard Kipling was at one point, and so on. And the Philippines GDP was as high as Japan in the 1950s. You know, and then within 30 years, it just turned totally the other way around. Right. So I apply that to how we think about geopolitics today and the grandstanding between countries like the U.S. and China, and China, for example, claiming to be, or rather, you know, trying to take the mantle of metal of being the leading country of the world in the next 20 or 30 years. It is not a given, you know, and India, you know, saying that, because of its size of its population, it stands a chance of, you know, regaining the wealth that it once used to have and stuff like that. It is not a given, you know, and then you go back and examine the elements that can cause a country to lose its way. You know, the elements of you know, dictatorship, lack of transparency, greed, and stuff like that. So. So when I read the headlines of in geopolitics and the grandstanding between countries, I try to decipher the elements that make that headline. So, for example, I spent a lot of time in China, and we now have entered the age of the internet, artificial intelligence. You know, GPT, the ability to process information. So what is the critical success factor of any country that is going to lead us into the future? The critical success factor is the ability to deal with information. And what does it take to deal with information? To its logical extreme, information both empowers societies as well as tears it apart. And if you ask me, I'd say that everything that is going on in the U.S. right now, in the way that the information society is creating silos of, you know, different opinion polls and tensions between people, these are natural, you know, natural effects of being an open society, you know, in the information age, whereas China takes the opposite approach of trying to curate information, you know, and then you ask yourself which of these two countries are likely to lead us into the future, and I'd go for the country which allows information to take us to its logical extreme, but that comes with a price. You know, and while a country like the U.S. pays that price, it then sets the motion that the new elements that we need, you know, to hold society together in a stable manner, you know, and so those are the elements that goes into my thinking. And a country that proscribes what you can think or what you can say cannot possibly be a natural purveyor of the information age, you know, because it's editing itself all the time, you know, that kind of thing. So when I think about the grandstanding, and I'm not saying this to criticize one or to, you know, to give the flag to another, but, you know, to say what are the elements that we need to look at. You know, I do think a lot about the debt situation in the U.S. And its capacity to generate the amount of debt it does. But as a percentage of GDP, actually the U.S. In relative numbers, the U.S. is not as indebted as some of the other leading countries in the world. So it's still got a long way to go. You know, so you go back to the basics of the economics, the numbers, to give you a sense of how it's holding together, not the newspaper headlines and you know, and the tensions and the issues that different countries you know, face.
Yeah, and I think the thought that I have on this is that, you know, thinking about the places you've traveled and the geopolitical landscape that exists in certain countries, how might that impact like entrepreneurial opportunities? Or if we have someone listening that knows they have a business that they operate in the US and they're thinking about expanding it, or they're wondering about maybe starting something that could be a global business, what factors should they consider? How can these opportunities really be heavily impacted by the geopolitical landscape of the countries you're operating in?
You know, Eric, I'm glad you asked that question, because what I've seen is that when I go to, really poverty-stricken countries in Africa, like Burundi, for example, and I see that the guy who runs the only satellite television network is a Chinese guy, right? And he didn't get there by the Belt and Road policy or anything like that. He just got there because he was probably running from the law somewhere else. He ended up in Burundi, and I met him actually, and had a quick word with him. And somehow the Burundians needed somebody who would give them cheap access to global entertainment. And he built that business. And nobody's like on his case at the moment. Like, he's rich. He's got full control over the capital city's entire television network. And he's happy. And I go through many countries in Africa. I meet Chinese people who you'd never think that they would go out to such difficult places and set up a business. And set up, a provision shop or a department store. And what they're actually doing is benefiting from the fact that all these made in China stuff can find its way to these small villages somewhere in Africa, and they figured out how to maintain inventory, make sure that they have good cash flow, and they have to think about security, and they also have to think about their children's education, and they band together and stuff like that. You'd never find an American doing that, and going out there and looking for economic opportunities and to create wealth. And on the other extreme, you go to a place like Connecticut in the US, and you see this entire armies of fund managers all huddled together and totally pleased with themselves, the rest of the world is far away. America is the best place to live in, and Connecticut is the best place in America to be in. And you cannot take them one step out of their comfort zone, and yes, they make lots of money, but they basically are birds of a feather that huddle together, and just to get them to New York for lunch is a big deal. Like you got to get them on the train, and you got to meet them at their club and all of that. So the mental makeup of entrepreneurs in different settings is dramatically different, and we need to think about how they're motivated. Can you become incredibly rich in the US? Yes, you can, because the US aggregates the wealth of the rest of the world, and if you are a fund manager, you'd have a piece of that action. You just need to plug into the process and be part of the community. As a rule of thumb, the more difficult the place is, the more opportunities there are to create wealth. And then you've got to, measure that against, the risks that you got to put up with, and where you're coming from. You might come from a difficult country yourself, where the opportunities are not as available as for some other people. In fact, when I meet a Chinese cleaning lady in New York who comes from a small town in China, and I asked her, I said, China is booming right now. Why aren't you working in Beijing or Shanghai? And she says to me in Chinese that whether I go to from where I come, the village that I come from, whether I go to Beijing or to New York is the same thing. I'm up against the same forces, and she doesn't speak English well. But because she wanted to raise her daughter and give her the best chance of a good education, so she made that journey to the US. So every single day, There are people who are making decisions that are incredibly difficult for themselves just because they are imagining something that they otherwise don't have. And you can say the same thing about people who rough it out as actors in New York or startup entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, which is they're there not because of the present. They're there because of a certain dream that they want to make available. So I'd say that for most entrepreneurs, the first thing you need to do is, of course, be totally in touch with what is best about ourselves. And then the second thing we need to do is, which community gives us the best opportunity to realize the best potential of ourselves. And some of us who have not got good education, who have not got very good communication skills, very limited even within the countries that we come from, a country as difficult as something in Africa might well be the best opportunity. And I see real people living those dreams, outside of their comfort zone.
Yeah, and you mentioned wealth a fair amount in that last response, Emmanuel. And I want to ask you, kind of your book, The Great Transition, The Personalization of Finances Here. What does wealth mean in the future? What do you really mean by that terminology, the personalization of finance? Could you define that for us?
Oh, wow. Eric, you're now taking me into technical ground, right? But let me make this as layman as possible, as simple as possible. Yes, the definition of wealth is in transition. Today, we think of a mortgage as being an access to an asset class that will become ours when we finish paying up the mortgage. And so we're willing to spend 30 years sitting on a mortgage until it's paid off. And then the house is yours, the valuation of the house goes up, and that's wealth. Imagine what wealth will look like if a mortgage is and in order to get into that mortgage, by the way, you've got to spend about 3 months going through all the paperwork, getting lawyers to check on the encumbrances around the property that you're looking at. You don't want to get the property wrong, right? Now, imagine what wealth will look like if a mortgage is something that a Gen Z, or now I've heard that there is a new generation coming on to Gen A or Gen Alpha, can complete at the touch of their finger on a mobile device in a second, because all mortgages, or rather all properties, are lodged digitally on a blockchain. All encumbrances are visible to everybody, just like all the cabs in town are visible to anyone who's using a Uber, right? There's enough transactions taking place in a working day that you can enter and exit out of a transaction as you like. So it's not inconceivable that the idea of property as an asset will become incredibly ephemeral. In fact, even with the institutions that are in the mortgage business, they don't hold the mortgage on their balance sheet anymore. They originate the mortgage and then they hive it off to the capital markets, which then hives it off and turns it into a derivative and then into a derivative of a derivative. So there are an incredible number of financial institutions today that are generating wealth, not on the back of an actual asset, but on a derivative of an asset, So now that kind of access to the information on a mortgage is now becoming available to ordinary people. So I'm saying that how the next two generations are going to define as well is becoming incredibly ephemeral. And it's also related to their lifestyle. I love my cars that I had before. And today, because I travel so much, I don't drive anymore. And I'm very happy getting onto a luxury car, which is available on the local Uber network. And as long as it's consistent, high quality, and good service, I'm happy. I'm so happy. Driving is no longer... my own mindset has changed so dramatically that from when I was a student where I would want to show off that I had a good car to where I am today, where I don't care what I'm driving or how I'm getting to a place, it's been a dramatic shift for me. In fact, I would never drive a gas car anymore. My next car would definitely be a electric car, and better still if it is a self-drive, or a autonomous vehicle, so which can go out there and operate on its own while instead of sitting in a garage. I'm well into that into that kind of culture as it's being built right now. So the personalization of finance is that transition that society is making into an age where wealth becomes something that is transient, lifestyle driven, it's amorphous. It's not solid stuff that you can own and claim prestige with. That in a nutshell, I think is a layman way of describing the personalization of finance. At the same time, the institutions themselves are changing. What they're selling to you is changing. So I tell the banks that nobody in the world wants a mortgage. They want a house, but a mortgage is a way of getting there. And in the future, with cryptocurrencies, with the ability to buy and sell assets or anything, a token of value in a network setting is going to need banks to start changing what they think they provide as a service or a product to their customers. So I say to the banks that if your products don't change, nothing changed. And I keep saying that to them when they're trying to define what innovation should look like going forward.
Yeah, that, and you mentioned the blockchain, and that kind of got me thinking, kind of really like the non-fungible aspect of an asset. Like, we've all heard of NFTs within the last few years and the boom with that in terms of just the popularity of people knowing about it. The question I have, the last question I'll ask you about this is, do you think that us as the United States will ever have like our own central bank digital currency? Like the dollar currently right now is physical. You have to hold it. You can see it on your bank account, but at the end of the day, something physical is changing hands. Do you think we'll ever get there in a digital sense, or is that something that may still not happen?
So I'm the only guy in the whole world who's saying now that CBDCs or central bank digital currencies are designed to fail. And they're designed to fail for a number of technical reasons that's got nothing to do with personal liberties, because I've spoken with some of the central bank governors of the countries that have already introduced CBDCs. The take-up is not as strong as it can be and so on. But what CBDCs are up against is the technology that's driving cryptocurrencies and stablecoins. And when you put them alongside each other, this is what you're looking at. Take any cryptocurrency, you take Ethereum, you take Solana, you take Tezos. Each one of them has got in the magnitude of hundreds of thousands of programmers building applications around them. And the applications are developed every single day. In other words, the platforms are being transformed by the sheer energy of the user base that's global. And open source computing, APIs, those are the drivers that are transforming the way in which money will look like going in the future. But if Janet Yellen, waves this white paper that she puts out saying that, the US should also have a digital currency and so on, just because every other major country in the world is talking about it, doesn't necessarily mean it's going to translate into reality. The reality is that there is a competition taking place between all the major forms of money. Even the fact that today your bank account, because of FedNow, is totally digital, you start looking at your deposit account very differently from someone 30 years ago. 30 years ago, a deposit account is something where you saved very cautiously, and there's compounded interest that gives you wealth, over a long period of time. But today, because of the digital nature of a deposit account, most depositors have a utilitarian view or utilitarian idea of what the deposit means. In other words, where can I use it? What can I use it for? Especially in the digital space, and especially with the new stuff that's coming on with the metaverse and so on. And the kind of token that's going to succeed in the new digital realm that we are creating today and the network economy, requires tokens that have a very strong utility element to it. And I think that the CBDCs are just not going to be able to keep up with the competition to get there. Now, there's a governance issue, which is, would you trust a central bank that issues currency which they can control and they can manage, the entire citizenry in terms of its usage of the of the token? Or would you like to see every bank in the country competing with each other, issuing their own stable coins? And that, to me, is a more likely outcome as we see this this race to tokenize the economy and to create a digital token that is usable as a currency. Now, the beauty of crypto is not that Bitcoin went up to 65,000 and all that, and not at all, will it also go up to $100,000 or $1 million and so on. The beauty of crypto is that each of us can create our own crypto. You can, I can, the person next to us can. It's just seven steps. You can go into the, you can go on Google and then you can create your own crypto. The question is, will the next guy accept my crypto in lieu of work, in lieu of value that I want to be able to, generate? And we've seen that those, like Sam Bankman-Fried, issues his own crypto. He even states his own price and everybody believed him. And then we saw what happened. And that kind of story is going to repeat again and again and again until we form a culture on building the checks and balances around how we define what a token should be and how we how we pay each other and recognize value in each other. In my book, the Great Transition, the personalization of finance is here. There's a small section where I discuss how the energy of the sun finds its way to a utility on the planet Earth, which is, the sun hits the planet, the chlorophyll turns it into energy, the animals eat the plants, and we eat the animals, and that's how energy transposes, from the sun to where we are. And that's a form of carrying a token of value through in nature. And the beauty of carrying token of value in nature is that there are no intermediaries in the process. Whereas in human society, in everything that we do, there is an intermediary. Even in something called decentralized finance today, there's an intermediary. And every player in decentralized finance wants to be the ultimate intermediary, just like central banks want to be the ultimate intermediary in central bank digital currencies. But I think that what technology is making possible, the whole idea of crypto is that it's permissionless, it's fundamentally permissionless. We're getting there to a realm where the intermediaries need to redefine the role that they need to play. So that, in a nutshell, is what the personalization of finance is and what we can look forward to, with central bank digital currencies and the future of money.
Yeah, that's all very interesting. And obviously, we'll see where we end up. I mean, it's very exciting to think of what it could be. And Emmanuel Daniel, really can't thank you enough for spending the time to be on the podcast today to talk about, the geopolitical landscape for entrepreneurs and talking about the future of wealth and the personalization of finance. So really grateful to you for that. If someone's listening and wants to reach out to you and learn more, what is the best way to contact you?
Oh, Eric, emmanueldaniel.com. That's my blog page. Actually, I've made it into like the meeting point of everything else that I do. So if you get there, you'll get to see the book. You'll see some of the points I just discussed, and the ideas that I'm working on, especially for my next book that's coming on, which is more about civilization than it is about finance.
Sounds perfect. Yeah, we'll tag all that in the show notes, drive a lot of traffic to your website. And Emmanuel Daniel, once again, thank you for being on the Eric Mueller Show. We'll look forward to keeping up with you in the future.
Thanks, Eric.